This is Echozoi Radio, episode 96 for April 2016 with Lyndon Unger on biblical modesty.
Welcome to Echozoi Radio, the podcast outreach of Echozoi Ministries, where you'll hear about important topics affecting the church today. Our primary goal is to explore a variety of issues while remaining faithful to God and His Word. Stay with us for the next hour as your host, Andy Olson, shares his conversation with this month's guest. Here's your host, Andy Olson.
I'm Andy Olson. Thanks for listening to Echozoi Radio. This is episode 96 for April 2016. My guest for this episode is Lyndon Unger, who first came on the show with me last May. He's a pastor, teacher, and blogger, and joins me in this episode to discuss the topic of a recent series of blog posts he wrote on biblical modesty. Check out the web post for this episode for an outline of the discussion, relevant links, scripture referenced, and related episodes. You can find that at echozoi.com/96. With that, here's my discussion with Lyndon Unger. Lyndon, thanks for coming back on. This is your second time with Echozoi Radio. Glad to have you back.
Hey, glad to be back. Thanks for having me again.
Yeah, I was just noting that because I do one episode a month, and my first one was in May of 2008. So my podcasting year starts in May, ends in April, and you were on last May. So you're kind of bookending year eight for me, starting and finishing.
Yeah. I didn't do that bad a job last time. I didn't offend as many people as I thought I did.
Well, I don't tend to get a whole lot of hate mail. I think what helps is that my blog or my WordPress installation is set up so that after 90 days, it automatically shuts off comments, because I figure after that point, there's a 99% chance it's either going to be haters or spammers. So there's no point in keeping it open more than 90 days. And So I ended up not getting a whole lot of feedback as through the comment section. And there's also some moderation set up too, so people have to be approved for their first comment on my site, and they're automatically approved second and subsequent times if I approve them. But that moderation helps. It means I don't get a lot of good feedback, but the bright side is I don't get a whole lot of bad feedback either. Most of it tends to be through Twitter and Facebook and other avenues, but no, we definitely did not get bad feedback. In fact, that was a really enlightening episode, and I was really enjoying that one. I've told people before, I love the history aspect, and you got really thick into the history of the renewal movement. And I tend to like Orthodox history a little better, but I'll take any history if it's at least from told through Orthodox eyes, so to speak. But
sure, it's the renewal history, especially the earlier stuff, is interesting too, because just we see guys like Todd Bentley and we think like he is just off the rails, but what we don't realize is that the early guys were just as bad, if mm-hmm. not worse. And the only reason that we don't really remember them as such is because, of course, the flow of information these days is that much more prevalent.
Yeah. Yeah. So interesting stuff. And for those who might be listening and think, what are you guys talking about? If you didn't hear that one, quick link is echozoi.com/85 for the May 2015 episode. We talked about the history of, you call it the renewal movement, and that's really like your Pentecostalism, your hardcore charismatics, and a lot of the just the nut jobs, I guess, as some people call them, that like Todd Bentley.
Sure. Yeah, I use the renewal as a blanket term, kind of, that covers Pentecostal, charismatic. I mean, you have in that kind of strain of Christianity, you have people who break it down in different ways. So I just use mm-hmm. the term renewal as kind of an umbrella term,
and it works well. So check it out, echozoi.com/85. But that's not the topic tonight. Tonight we're talking about biblical modesty, and you're not surprised.
What?
I tricked you. We're not talking about renewal again. No, we're going to talk about biblical modesty. And you know, it's always interesting how these topics come up. Some, you know, that's always different, often different. And I was looking at, I'm coming up on April today. We're recording on April 4th, but April is coming up and don't have an episode ready and don't have a guest. And so this one, I actually was looking through my history and who have I not talked to for a little while. And, oh, there's Lyndon. Lyndon was interesting. What has Lyndon written on lately? And I came across your article series on biblical modesty and started reading, and it was really good. So glad you could come on and talk about it with me.
Oh, thanks so much. I'm glad someone's interested.
Well, you tend to get more comments. I was just talking about the blog comments. You tend to get more than I do. And there's, when you're done listening to the episode, go look. I'll put links to the articles. Check out the articles, but check out the comments too, because they're interesting.
I have a way of kind of stimulating people to be angry enough to say something. Because that tends to be what it is, that people only speak up if they really love it or it just offends them. I tend to have a little bit of a way about me that I can just motivate people to get on their keyboards.
That's just the internet. That's just the way the internet works. You know, if people enjoy you enjoy it and then you move on. You don't dwell on how great things are, but when somebody kind of pricks your conscience or says something that you disagree with, people start mashing that keyboard.
Yeah, no kidding. I've seen that all the time. Yeah, where people just come back and it's all caps and you're a fool. And, you know, yeah, you definitely know there's some emotion behind that.
So what was the impetus behind setting out to study this this topic of modesty?
Well, modesty has been one of those topics that I've been aware of for a long time. Being a guy, it's not huge on my radar so much, but my wife, she has read stuff and she had come to me several times, just having books that she'd be reading, and she'd ask, you know, hey honey, come look at this. This seems really weird. And she'd give me a book and it would all of a sudden come out and it'd be some author who generally is decent, but she gets the modesty stuff and she'd end up, the author would end up quoting scripture and then subtly twisting it. You know, he'd end up with a list of rules or some general guidelines about what type of clothes you can wear or how you can do your hair and this and that. And my wife would look at it and be like, that doesn't seem like the Bible is giving me a list. It seems like it's giving me some kind of a general principle. And the author wouldn't address the principle and would just kind of turn whatever verse into a list or just kind of arbitrarily pull out some random verses and construct a list of rules. And so I had it on my back burner for a while, but I wanted to look at modesty and I hadn't really tackled it. But it's all, of course, an issue that comes up for girls a lot, especially in, well, not girls, but women's ministry. I mean, not just young girls, but older women too. And so then I decided to kind of give it a treatment and I wanted to go and really get behind the cultural setting of Paul's day. And so in, we talk about modesty. The second post, you look at modesty or the word modest in a concordance, you're not going to find a lot of occurrences in it in your Bible. Mm-hmm. And so you look at modesty in your ESV and it only appears twice. And so it's, you know, it's 1 Corinthians 12:23 and then 1 Timothy 2:9. And 1 Timothy 2:9 is really the verse that people go to. And often they get hung up on the gold hair or braided hair, the gold or braided hair. And they end up, the general consensus that I tended to find was that those things were indicative of what makes someone a prostitute. That was kind of the uniform of a harlot in Paul, in, you know, the Apostle Paul in ancient, you know, Near Eastern culture. And just logically, that always seems strange to me because you think, I mean, Paul's writing in 1 Timothy, he's writing to the church in Ephesus under the leadership of Timothy. And so there's some sort of difficulty there. And apparently, Timothy can't sort through that women in church shouldn't dress like a hooker. And that, but sounds, when you think about it, you think that seems like something that Timothy should be able to sort out. He doesn't need to really kind of call on Paul for.
Yeah.
And so, I thought about that often. I thought, you know, there's got to be more to it. And so I wanted to dig out actual kind of Roman and, you know, historical resources. And I ended up having to, you know, get a few books and dig through some journal articles. And all of a sudden, as I started reading through that, I realized, wow, my understanding of Roman culture was wrong. And so that ends up changing the thrust of the principle that's in 1 Timothy 2 and also that comes up in 1 Peter 3. Mm-hmm. Two portions of the New Testament that mentions, you know, gold hair and braided hair, yep, and talks about clothing a little bit. And so that's kind of the impetus behind it. And I went in not knowing what I would find. And then when I got through my study, then I produced the blog series, and that kind of lays out all the answers to all the questions that I was asking in the text.
Yeah, and it's 7 posts. You keep each one relatively short, so it's not a long read. But what drew me in, I mentioned already that I'm always drawn into history. I love talking about history, especially church-related history. And but I also have a penchant towards where somebody who's careful with both grammatical and historical context and is careful with how they approach text will challenge kind of general thoughts and general kind of the common sense, so to speak, of how we approach different texts. And my friend, ministry partner, and board member Ryan Hobbin is really good at this, and I love how he does it too. We've done some stuff on like tongue speaking and whatnot, and where that he'll just kind of forget everything that he's been taught, and when you clearly forgot everything you've been taught on this subject, and just go in and look at what is it really teaching, what's the historical context, and come out with a bit of a different conclusion than what most people would assume going in. As Christians, we get saved and we start reading our Bibles and we listen to a lot of sermons, and when we're first saved, a lot of times we don't know a good sermon from a bad sermon, and so we hear things and it sounds reasonable, so we just kind of tuck it away and just assume that, well, that's how things are explained, and move on, and no reason to question it until somebody says, well, just for whatever reason, I'm gonna question it.
Yeah, that's true. And that's kind of where I came at with this. And I was suspicious that my understanding of it was off, but I didn't know how.
Uh-huh. Well, and that's how good studies come about, is when you don't really know, and then you're drawn in and you're forced to look at it, all the different angles and what was going on and what was the culture like and, you know, what was the audience and how was this city different from that city? And, where was Paul? Like, where was he in his life? And where was he in his ministry? And all these different things can kind of come together to paint a much bolder, clearer picture than just what you might hear in on a radio sermon as you're driving to work one day.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, that's kind of what I tried to do, just kind of go through it and really get behind the text in a cultural sense. Because in the New Testament, there's just certain times where kind of the context as far as grammatical historical needs a little bit of help, mm-hmm, because you're dealing with a worldview where there's common figures of speech or common understandings that are no longer common.
Yeah.
So, and that's what I think what's going on in 1 Timothy 2, that the common understanding of what gold hair and braided hair, what that meant, mm-hmm, has that's now gone. And so when Paul just kind of throws that out, that the people in his day wouldn't have any misunderstanding about it, because that was a common thing. It's like these days, you know, talking about an iPhone, you go back 100 years ago, you talk about an iPhone, nobody has a clue what you're talking about.
Yeah. And 100 years from now, that will be the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it would be the same thing. I mean, we're talking, this is culture that's 2,000 years ago.
Yeah.
So well, they, you know, certain things that are...
I want to back up just a little bit. I mean, you're kind of jumping into, you know, post 2 of 7. But you start off by addressing different mindsets. Who was your audience and who were you writing for?
Well, my audience was really, I mean, I kind of broke it up loosely into 4 categories. And so the first one was kind of the woman who wants to be modest, wants to understand the Bible, but they don't really get satisfactory answers. Mm-hmm. And those are really the women I was aiming at. That's kind of where my wife was and a lot of her friends. And my wife had some friends that had been bugging me. And I have had this in the works since August. I've been working on this for a long time, but I'm you know, working and have kids and this and that. So I devote a, you know, a couple hours a week, maybe at best, to it. And doing the kind of research I did, it just took time to figure out who is reliable in the field and then find out what they've written and kind of sort through their stuff and then kind of seeing the patterns. And so I was aiming more at the women are out there that kind of want to study the scripture, want to understand this issue, but they just can't really find good resources. And when they read typical women's ministry resources, the authors of typical women's ministry resources, I'm not going to drop names because I don't want to kind of seem like I'm hammering on anyone. Mm-hmm. But a lot of those women just lack the faculty to do the sort of work that was required for this. Yep. And so they end up trusting commentaries, or they end up just kind of basically going with whatever they think sounds good. And really it's an arbitrary thing where whatever sounds convincing to them, they're like, oh, that sounds good. And I kind of pass on the information.
Well, it's a subject that's like I kind of said, is it's so easy to do that. It's just so easy that, well, this sounds good, you know? We're going to set up, you know, some cultural norms for modesty. What should modesty be? And that sounds reasonable, and it's easy to not question it.
Yeah, and you kind of have a general consensus. Well, modesty means you have to dress a certain way, and you don't have, and you know, and you don't be flirty, and you don't show off your legs, and you know, as long as whatever the women who are writing the biblical modesty books or treatments of modesty, as long as they're within those certain parameters, then they can say whatever they want. And everyone's like, well, sure, you know, and they'll pull in a nugget here and there, and they'll grab some obscure verse from the Old Testament, so it's all kind of, oh wow, there's a gem here, I've never noticed that, and it's mm-hmm. impressive. It kind of distracts you from the fact that they're just really recycling the status quo.
Yeah. And what's interesting is that it is what is being addressed in the question of modesty. And we're going to get into it, you know, in this discussion, because it's really important. But what is it that we're trying to either communicate or not communicate in our modesty as Christians?
Yeah, that's a big thing, right? Because when you get to the series, I've got 8 posts, really. Mm-hmm. And all the way up to the 7th one, I don't really deal with what people would normally assume is modesty.
Right.
Kind of the clothes and how you dress and whatnot, because that's what I gained as I was studying through it, is that's not really what Paul's concerned with.
Mm-hmm.
And the questions that we're asking about how women should dress, and really what it boils down to, is how much skin they're allowed to uncover and where.
Yeah.
What skin on their body can they uncover? Those questions would have not even arisen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for the people in Paul's day, because women generally all wore the same uniform. You know, the women would wear, well, I would jump in ahead again on what they're wearing, but they all wore the same kind of clothes. And so, and they covered up very much, like they were covered up from head to toe. And so the idea of, I mean, of even what passes for quote unquote modest clothes in our culture, in Paul's culture, would have been kind of almost unthinkable.
Mm-hmm.
So the questions that Paul is dealing with are totally different than what we're going with, than what we tend to think about of, you know, can I bare my knees? Can I have a skirt that's above the knee? How far above the knee? Can I bare my shoulders? Can I wear a tank top? You know, what about bathing suits and wedding dresses and blah, 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 blah. And you end up having this, basically, you almost end up having this handbook of rules.
Yeah.
And I've read stuff on the internet. I've read books that have, like, you end up getting like dozens of rules, and it's just absurd.
Yeah, it ends up trapping people in a form of legalism, really. And it ends up being, you know, as you said, arbitrary rules that, because the scripture doesn't ever explicitly say. I mean, there are principles given, but there's nothing explicit as far as what you're to cover and what you're to reveal and whatnot.
Yeah, and in its worst form, it becomes a litmus test for spirituality.
Yeah,
and women tend to judge other women and whether, you know, how serious they are about the Lord on the basis of their clothing and what they wear.
Yeah,
and that's definitely not what modesty is about.
Yeah.
Because often, you know, there are whole movements where the word modesty is associated, or is basically synonymous with spiritual.
Yeah. Bias, yeah.
And
before we get before we get too far, so you've got the woman who is seeking to understand biblical modesty, and then you've got three others as well. You're looking for...
The women who kind of, and then there's the group that still want to, kind of like the first one, but they associate modesty with something in history. They kind of arbitrarily select just kind of a period of time, and it's, you know, more or less boils down to whatever they think is modest. Uh-huh. So, you know, and the older you are, the further back that time period goes.
Yeah. And what did grandma wear?
Yeah, and it's kind of, and they kind of tend to think of, when I was a kid, people dressed this way, that's better, therefore that's what I should enforce on everyone else.
Yeah, what did my grandma wear when she was my age?
Yeah, and kind of, it's funny because the way clothing went, I mean, you can go back hundreds of years and it's still incredible. You know, you can find racy clothing, you can find a lot of exposed skin. Mm-hmm. You can go back 75 years or 100 years and that was still what happened, and you can find that, you know, you can find people all through history that wore things that would be racy even by today's standards, but it's just a question of what you're looking at and what section of the culture you want to grab and hold up as kind of spiritual or something to emulate. And obviously, you know, nobody goes back and looks at Hollywood in the 1950s and says that's what modesty is. Mm-hmm. But you know, they pick out maybe, you know, 50s or 1970s or 1980s or even 90s. And you know, I know some younger girls that look back at kind of the music they listened to back when, you know, Salty the Singing Songbook was putting out albums. And they look at how people dressed back then, you know, women with sweaters with shoulder pads. And they're like, yeah, that's kind of modesty. And it's like, no, it's not a question of finding the right era. Uh-huh. And so those women, I was writing for those women too, because they tend to be, they tend to have the wrong association with modesty, but they really want to be biblical. They want to be modest, and they just don't really have teaching. So they're left with history, and that's kind of the only thing they have.
Yeah. Well, I think I get drawn back to a comment that Frank Turk made when I talked to him in December, and we were talking about relationships with a local church and the whole idea of, you know, as Christians, we're always kind of pining for this time when the church was more more dominant and morals seemed to be stronger and whatnot. And Frank was so succinct, and he just says, look, there was no golden era. There never was a golden era. And he was talking about church history, but it applies to anything. And he said as much, you know, when it comes to apparel, there was no golden era. Things might have been a little different in the past, but it wasn't a golden era. They had their problems too.
And it's funny. I mean, going to the renewal movement, the early 50s, that was the mark of, I mean, if we think the faith healing and charlatanism is bad now, the 50s was worse by 10 times. Hmm. That was coming right out of World War II, and the kind of the era where we think of, you know, some people think of modesty as kind of the golden era of modesty is the 50s.
Uh-huh.
And yet that was the era where 3/4 of the heresy that we're fighting today emerged.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it all got popularized. And think of guys like Oral Roberts going around the countryside and building a ministry and having like tents of, he had a tent and he seat like something like 16,000 people or something.
Wow.
It was just absolutely bizarre. And like his tents were bigger 16,000 than the Ringling Brothers.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah. And like holding wooden chairs. And
I went to college in Fargo, North Dakota, and they had a stadium they built for the college football team called the Fargo Dome. And I think that only seated 14,000 people. Maybe it was 18. I don't know. So that would be a big tent. I mean, they had a football field in the middle, but.
Wrong. Yeah. The number 16,000 might be wrong, but it was huge. It was, his tents were bigger than like the Ringling Brothers, and Bailey and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And he had the biggest touring tents, and then him and another guy had competitions to get the bigger tents, and they had to like get custom made tents.
Wow.
And they couldn't find people to build them because they were making the tents so big. And that was kind of, these guys were going around, and I remember reading once that these guys had an offering once, and it was, they raised, like, and we're talking in the 50s when you could buy a car for $500. They would have offerings, and they would have like six-figure offerings back then.
Wow.
And it's just, and you know, and they were just the radio ministry and television, and it was all just faith healers, and half of those guys, you know, were disqualified from ministry by the law. In other words, they, you know, got arrested for DUI, or they, you know, tax evasion, or this, and they all ended up getting arrested or something, or they killed themselves by the wild choices and the wild life they lived behind the scene. And it was just kind of that golden era. That wasn't a golden era. That was a horrible time for the church. I mean, the church was just ransacked with all this false teaching. And you think about how much that has affected us, and how many movements came out of that that now are just basically destroying the church. And yeah, I mean, you know, women covered up more back then, but that's not necessarily the golden era of Christianity at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. The third girl, the girls who want to kind of be modest by the standards of the day, right? Mm-hmm. They want to be seen modest in culture. They want their non-Christian friends to think of them as kind of Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And that boils down to dressing, right? And they tend to be a little bit confused on the issue. And then, of course, the fourth one is the girls who just want to be Christian hotties.
Mm-hmm.
And I've gone to church with a few of those girls in the past, and they want to dress like the culture, and they basically think that modesty is a problem that more or less is the fault of the Christian guys, because they should be allowed to dress however they want.
Right.
And and the guys can't control themselves because they're Christian guys are worse than secular guys. And I've had that conversation before with several dozen girls where, you know, their boyfriend is not a Christian. You know, he's quote unquote more Christian than the Christian guys because he doesn't ogle me all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and it's like, well, no, it's because the guy has basically filled his mind with pornography. He's not interested in you. That's what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're not basically appealing to him because there's a whole other serious world of problems there. But of course they find that out far too late, and then they're very unhappy.
Yeah.
But those girls tend to be the ones who, I mean, they're not going to read anything that I've written. They're not going to read it and care. But they're the women who are in church that the women's in groups 1 and 2 get a chance to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the girls that maybe when they have a breakdown and they're crying and their mascara is running, the older godly women in the church can come up and talk to them about it. And if the issue comes up, they might be able to point them in a good direction.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm ready for all four groups, but I know only from the first two will really pay attention.
Yeah. So then I want to jump in. Then you brought up 1 Corinthians 12 and 1 Timothy 2 are kind of the big verses, and talked a little bit about what those verses really are covering and what are they addressing?
Well, 1 Corinthians 12:23 and 1 Timothy 2:9 are the two places where I was looking at the ESV and you find the word modesty, and it only appears twice in the Bible. And so when we're talking about modesty, it's not a topic that most people obviously don't know Greek or Hebrew, so they're just looking up the word in their Bible and that's what they find.
Uh-huh.
So women will camp out usually in 1 Timothy 2:9, and then they're also camp out in 1 Peter 3 because the word modesty doesn't appear, but a lot of similar vocabulary appears.
Yeah.
And then 1 Corinthians 12 is one where I find people talking about it, but they kind of go over it in passing, and they tend to read it and think of kind of parts of the body that we cover up and kind of make deductions about covering things up, and it turns into an easy way of, you know, turning into a list of rules about covering things and treating the unpresentable parts. I often think about that as kind of our bathing suit, and the areas that are covered by your bathing suit and your shoulders and whatnot, and then we treat them with greater modesty by covering them. And so I kind of went through that passage and just dealt with that, and really the idea of parts that are honorable and parts that are dishonorable, and the idea is not kind of shape but more behavior. And instead of translating the word modest, I kind of treated it more as treating the word as courtly. So as idea of, instead of, because the word modest just carries connotations of clothes.
Uh-huh.
So I wanted to escape that. And I kind of like the word courtly as a way of acting regally. You think of, and I put a picture up of, you know, the Queen and Prince William and Kate. Uh-huh. And just kind of, I mean, somebody came after me for that picture because apparently Kate is not on it. And, but the idea that, that royalty has a way of conducting themselves. And they, you don't, I mean, you hear about, you know, the young royals going off and doing something stupid, but of course you hear about it because they hit the tabloids. But generally speaking, in public, they're always collected. They're always carried. They dress very covered up. They're always, you know, gracious and whatnot. And so the idea of modesty is more this behavior. It's a demeanor of kind of regality. Mm-hmm. And so that's the idea. It's acting, as if you are
dignified.
You know, dignified and and somebody who is very prestigious. And so it's the idea of demeanor. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of what I pulled out of 1 Corinthians 12. And I kind of grabbed a few other passages that have some related terms and kind of magnified that. And the first thing we do is kind of definitely the verse that people or women tend to really run to. 1 Timothy 2:9, likewise also that women should adorn themselves in respectable apparel with modesty and or with modesty and self-control, not with braided hair or gold pearls or costly attire. And so the idea there that people could take the respectable apparel and they turn that right away into a list of rules of clothes, and modesty and self-control means to like control yourself in how you dress, not with braided hair or gold or pearls or costly attire. And they turn that into, often what I hear is that's how prostitutes dress in time of Paul. And so you want to not dress like a prostitute, and gold, you know, braided hair and gold and pearls was how they, you know, what they did. And you don't want to do that. So instead you want to be respectable, which means here's my list of all the different things you can wear. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of walked through that text and I talked about that a little bit, talked about, you know, it's interesting that the word modesty, the word in 1 Corinthians 12 is a different Greek term than the one that appears in 1 Timothy 2. And 1 Timothy 2 is, the word cosmos, which often kind of, it's used for the world, and it's a word with a wide range of meanings in the New Testament. Uh-huh. But the idea of the arrangement, and it kind of carries the idea of arrangement. And so how you arrange yourself, and that's kind of the modesty, respectable.
You talked about the word catastella or catastole, depending on whether it's a noun or verb. Was that the first?
That was a comment.
Pardon?
That was in a comment, I think. Somebody brought that up. Respectable apparel. Oh, yeah.
Right, but
yeah,
then you linked back to it, though. You said check out this verse because we talked about this subject in a comment. And was that derivative of the 1 Corinthians, the catastella?
No, that's 1 Timothy. That's the respectable apparel, right? And so the idea of orderly apparel.
Uh-huh.
And
that word was the hapax logamon there. That was the only time in scripture that word is used.
Yeah, I'm actually going to go dig through that comment right now. I'll jump to it and look at it. Yeah, kind of silly. Yeah, so it's a word that appears once, and it's a technical term. So Paul talks about he basically, I think, makes that term up.
And yeah, not the first time. He tends to do that a lot.
Yeah, whenever he lacks a word, he just kind of grabs something and grabs two words and makes a term that carries the idea of what he wants.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's the idea of, you're letting down or your deportment or what you wear. And so he wants to you to adorn yourself, and that's the word cosmeo, which is for me cosmos. That's kind of arrange yourself with orderly apparel. It's the stuff that you whatever you drop down around your stuff, it's suitable attire. Whatever you drop around your, whatever drops down over you, make it accorded. And then he talks about that. Now it's with modesty, and the Greek term there basically means something that you don't, it's something that's, the word he uses is, the word for modesty is, sorry, I said before it was cosmeo, it's not, it's adios. And he uses a word that kind of talks about averting your eyes. It's, it's an alpha privative with, to look at someone. And so the idea of you dress in a way that you're averting your eyes from them, that you're humble, mm-hmm. and that you're not trying to draw attention to yourself. So I put in the blog that it's not be able to be doormat, but rather one who shows appropriate honor and you show respect to other people.
Yeah.
And you defer to others. And then self-control, again, is another term that qualifies it. And then he contrasts that with braided hair, gold pearls, and costly attire. And so then that led to the other post, and I said, well, okay, hang on a second. What's he doing then? What is braided hair? What does that mean? What does that communicate? What does gold and pearls communicate? And then the idea of costly attire, I dealt with that later on. Mm-hmm. And it's precious, right? It's expensive attire. And so then that led me to the third post, which is kind of...
Well, before you get there, I just wanted to mention, I liked how you put this with this catastello or catastole.
Okay.
And I'm pronouncing different words, but you make a point. It's the noun versus the verb. It's not that I can't pronounce it. One's a noun, one's a verb. And
sure.
But that when you break down the word, because Paul had a way of doing things like... I often hear, you know, like James White talks about homosexuality, and he debates homosexuality, and Paul uses a word, and it escapes me what the word is, but he made up a word to talk about what, you know, like homosexuality. It basically means like a man layer, like somebody who lays
with,
and it basically means someone who lays with a man, you know, and he just kind of makes two words a compound word, and that's what he's doing here. And you say, well, that's kind of a butterfly fallacy.
Yeah.
Butterflies have nothing to do with butter or flies. They're
right.
I like that point.
Yeah. Well, people tend to talk this. They break it down. Well, yeah, guys. What I wrote was the guys who mine out the term often break down catastole. Guys who go to the Greek will break down that term into its components and build a definition.
Uh-huh.
And they'll say kata means to let down, and stole means a garment let down. So it means a long garment that's let down to the very bottom of the legs. Hence, you have to cover your legs up. Uh-huh. The guys will run through scripture, and they'll talk about how buried legs are associated with shame. And the doctor of the Bible talks about skirt lengths, and all of a sudden they'll start drawing out concrete rules about skirt lengths.
Yeah,
and that's a butterfly fallacy, right? Kata and sole, it's, you know, butterfly. The butterfly fallacy is that, you know, yeah, butterflies have neither butter nor flies in them. It's a term that's put, you know, that's used, but it's not. You can't break it down into the two terms that compose it in order to find the proper meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And catastole doesn't necessarily do that either. And so the problem is, well, and what I kind of mentioned was that it's the verb stello, from which the noun stole is derived, is also appears twice in the Bible, and the noun stole is possibly from actually the word stola, which is the term that the common term that everyone would know, that is the dress of a Roman woman. And so basically guys kind of can milk the term, and they can talk about arrangement and deportment, you know, apparel. But I said, well, there's really no reason why kata would be according to the stola. They can say kata plus stola and make catastole.
Yeah.
And that would be, you know, just, I mean, it makes sense of saying, you know, well, you have to dress according to what is fitting for women.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
And what is suitably feminine. And so when Paul says he wants women to dress, you know, to adorn themselves in respectable apparel, well, it's, you know, dress like women, dress like respectable women, right?
Yeah.
I
want to get into that next. I'd like to cut a break quick, if you don't mind.
Sure.
So I've been playing these promos, and I mentioned it a few times before. I've played them in the past, but I've got a new one I'm going to play. So I play a promo for Landon Chapman, my friend at Fireaway Podcast and Entreating Favor, and hopefully my listeners are familiar with them by now. But so I want you to hear from Landon, and then I got a new one that I want to play. My friends, I've got friends in a church in Weyburn, Saskatchewan. Kevin Lackey specifically is a friend of mine, an elder up there at that church, and they are holding a conference in August, and I want to promote this conference. It's called Reformation Saskatchewan. And it's a awesome conference on the five solas. Both preachers from our church are going to be speakers there. And so I'm going to play that promo too, so people can hear and get more information on that. And I highly recommend it. I wish I could go, but so here's Landon and Reformation Saskatchewan.
This is Echo Zoe Radio.
My name is Landon Chapman, and I want to tell you about the Fire Away Podcast. The Fire Away Podcast is the radio ministry of IntrudingFavor.com and the IntrudingFavor.com website. Each week, I discuss a variety of topics from a mostly Reformed viewpoint, ranging from current events to scriptural exposition. My goal is to be faithful to the Word of God, to glorify Him, and in the spirit of 2 Corinthians 3:18, be transformed into Christ's likeness. You may find the Fireway Podcast at IntrudingFavor.com, SermonAudio.com, subscribe on iTunes, or subscribe using your favorite podcatcher application.
Hi, this is J.D. Hall, and I would like to take the time to invite you to a conference happening August 5th and 6th. Hosted by my friends, the Gospel of Grace Fellowship in Weyburn, Saskatchewan, the name of the conference is Reformation Saskatchewan. You can find out more about the conference by going to the website reformationsaskatchewan.org. The theme of this year's conference is the five solas of the Reformation, and as we approach the 500th anniversary of the Reformation, we ask the question, do the solas still matter? Does it still matter that we are saved by grace alone, through faith alone, in Christ alone, and that we know this by the Scripture alone, and that it's all done for God's glory alone? Does it still matter, or are these merely dinosaurs of an age gone by? I think you know our answer. Speakers at the conference will include Harley Porter, Kevin Armstrong, Eric Duma, Bob DeWay, and me. You can find out more about the conference again, which is August 5th and 6th, hosted by the Gospel of Grace Fellowship. The venue is Calvary Baptist Church in Weyburn, Saskatchewan, by going to the website reformationsaskatchewan.org. I don't know about you, but I'm praying for a reformation in Canada and beyond. We hope to see you there.
Before the break, we were talking about the catastole, and I think that it was a good place to break, but I want to get into that, like you said, clothing befitting of a woman. And so let's talk about that Roman cultural norms. What did a woman typically wear? And maybe talk a little bit about the prostitute angle. What would set a prostitute apart that obviously a Christian woman wouldn't want to dress like?
Right. Well, in Roman culture, when you kind of look into Roman clothing, Roman women all basically wore the same thing. I mean, they wore men would wear the toga. I'm very familiar with togas. And women would wear a garment that was very similar called the stola. And the stola was basically this long kind of a wraparound garment that was draped over the body and kind of tied down loosely. And then they'd also have a thing called a palla, which was a head covering or like some sort of scarf that they would wear over their head. And so women tended to all dress very similarly. Mm-hmm. And so the style for Roman women, there wasn't a lot of variety. So then the women who wanted to set themselves apart would use their hair, because that was the kind of the one thing they could have exposed. And the woman who wanted to set themselves apart in a different way, who wanted to be known kind of as a woman of, well, basically prostitutes, they would dress in a toga like a man. But they would wear a toga that was made out of a very, very fine silk that was semi-translucent. So it would kind of show off. You could probably, I don't know, I haven't seen one, but from what I read, you could see through it, or it was very revealing, at least, and you would, might not see through it, but it was very suggestive.
Maybe the same concept behind like a wet t-shirt?
Yeah, sort of, yeah. And and so it was, the prostitutes would kind of dress like a man, and then they would wear, they'd have a toga that was made out of, yeah, very different fabric, so they were very distinct. And so women who wanted to dress basically provocatively, apparently, from what I've read in my reading, that some young women would sometimes copy the toga, and they would try and dress provocatively. Uh-huh. And that was not what you do. Of course, you dress and you wear a proper stola and pala. So that was women's dress, and all women wore that. And I mean, basically, everyone was covered up from head to toe. Just a question of with what.
Yeah.
And so the idea of kind of skirt length, bare shoulders, whatever, that really doesn't come up. And so even the modern kind of versions, you'll see kind of the Halloween costumes and whatnot, they're not really at all accurate to what I could find.
Uh-huh.
And I had some, you know, I had a picture or two of some sculptures that really kind of showed that it was very, I mean, it was basically women all wore a tarp. And so it was like the least flattering thing you can imagine.
Uh-huh.
And so, yeah, that kind of leads you to then, how do they show themselves, set themselves apart? Because, I mean, if they want to show, they want to, you know, show off basically that they're a woman of prestige or whatever, well, you don't really have much options with kind of a big tarp that you're wearing. So you can kind of put a brooch on it, maybe, or you can have something that's made of kind of, you know, expensive cloth, but even that didn't really do it at all. And so then that leads to the hair, because of course the question is, what did the women wear in Paul's day? And they all wore the same thing, unless they were a prostitute, and that was a very distinct thing. And ancient writers would write about women, you know, young women who try and dress like a prostitute, but they were mocked and they were scorned, and it was kind of seen as very degrading.
Mm-hmm.
And so Rome was an interesting culture where the social norms were very firm, and anyone who kind of tried to dress in a way that was, you know, see-through clothes or, you know, a little bit of nudity, that was seen as being a barbarian. Romans were very civilized. They were very proud of the fact they were not like the barbarians who would walk around kind of naked and whatnot. And so they were very cultured. They were very arrogant about their culture, their hairstyles, their clothes, their jewelry, the things that set them apart from kind of the people that they conquered. And so a young woman dressing in a way that would show off her body or in a revealing way was seen as being barbarian, and that was not tolerated. Even though young women would do it, it was basically almost universally condemned. And so then if a Roman woman wants to show off kind of her wherewithal and show she's a woman of means, then what would happen is they would tend to have to do that with their hair, because the pala covered the back of the head. It was kind of from the middle of the head back.
Mm-hmm.
And so female hairstyles were ordered towards the front. And Roman hair, when you see kind of statues, it would have, you know, elaborate braids in the back, but often the pala would cover that up. And then they'd have these huge stacks of curls. They'd part their hair from ear to ear over the top of their head, and the front part would just be this massive stack of curls.
It's just weird looking. I mean, by our standards, our time, it's really weird looking. And I almost commend people to check out the posts just for the pictures of the hair. It's really interesting. I mean, you've got busts that were carved obviously back in the Roman times that show, you know, the hair of the period. It's almost like Battlestar Galactica type, you know, it's
science fiction.
Yeah, you hear these weird science fiction shows set off in a distant galaxy far in the future. It's kind of what you might expect to see on some of those weird shows.
Yeah, these kind of other planets where they just have, you know, no connections to Earth. I'm guessing that's where the science fiction writers find their inspiration, right? They look back
at
the past,
could well be.
Wow. Yeah, that's weird. And then they kind of make sort of alien race do that. And they, you know, and people watching don't realize it's just ancient Romans they've encountered that live on space. But the women who would do that, they would have these elaborate hairstyles, and they would do them like regularly. Sometimes, I mean, the women who would do them sometimes would do it daily, or they would put a lot of stuff in their hair to make it kind of last for a few days. But they would have curling irons. They would have even slaves, because these hairstyles, they'd have multiple. Some women would have multiple slaves to put together this hair. And they'd have to sit there for hours while these women would curl their hair and style it and stack the curls. And you'd have to, I mean, in some of the pictures, in order to make that work, you'd have to actually put in a lot of work to stack curls like that. And it's just bizarre to think of the amount of effort that would go into that. And how they would, and then they would end up using accent wings, which is the gold. And they would often use color, because they don't actually, you know, I don't think they really would. I mean, they would maybe put some sort of gold tassel or some sort of gold like pin or something. But if you wanted gold, it was kind of, I don't think Rome really had the ability to do gold, like, you know, do with gold what we can now, to make, like, you know, they would make like a brooch or something, but they couldn't do kind of like glitter or something like that. That wasn't, I don't think they really did stuff like that. And so what they would do is they would have wigs that would be an accent wig, and the wigs were very expensive, because of course they would dye their hair. You know, poor women would dye their hair, and they would use red wine, or they would use there's one thing where they would apply leeches, and leeches that have rotted for 40 days in red wine that would give off this really strong color. They'd soak their hair in the water, and then they would color it, right? And you're thinking, like, oh my goodness, trying to get a woman today, what, like, to just lean over a bowl of rotten leeches for half an hour kind of does its work on her hair? Oh, yeah, that's commitment, right?
Yeah.
And like, that would stink, and it would be gross. But you know, you do what you do for it to look good.
Yeah.
And the women who had money, of course, would buy wigs and not kind of just soak their hair in rotten leech water or whatever. And the wigs would have to be imported, right? And so natural color of the hair is what made those wigs desirable. And so black wigs would come from India. Mm-hmm. And that was imported hair. But of course, Germany was blonde hair, and that was spoils of war. So they, you know, the Romans would conquer kind of these people in the north that had blonde hair, and they would bring back blonde hair, and so they'd make a wig, or like an accent wig, or some sort of, maybe kind of a hair piece they would put on top of the braids, and it would be blonde. And that was extremely expensive. And so it would be kind of something that would really set a woman apart. And so that's when I kind of, as I started reading through the history, realized, okay, well, that's the gold hair, and that kind of explains the costly attire, right? Because
but the point of all that is that it's not, they're not communicating like a promiscuous nature through their dress or their hair. They're communicating their financial status.
Right. And so it's the women who are doing this are trying to show that they are women of means, and they're prestigious, and they have pull, maybe the cultural pull, that they can somehow get this color, this German hair. That's a, you know, they know someone in the military, and that would advertise that, and also they have money to pay for it.
Uh-huh.
And it's kind of, it'd be the idea of, you know, actually in a later post, I had a picture of Louis Vuitton bag.
Yeah.
Where, you know, it's something that's really expensive. And the only reason you do that is because, you know, other women that follow trends recognize that. And so you do it to be seen, and people to say, wow, that's like, that's a $6,000 handbag. Wow. And then they're impressed, and they right away, they assume you have lots of money, or you know somebody who does, and you're a person of influence, or you're friends with people of influence. And either way, it means that you're kind of better than they are.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what it communicated. And so it was the idea of two of, you know, you hear about people who have, like, you know, diamond buttons on their cell phones, or you have, you know, very kind of ostentatious things, iPad cases that are made of sealskin leather or whatever. And you, you know, as a guy, I see that and I don't pick it out, but it's not for me. It's for other women who they know who recognize it.
Yeah.
And they want them to see it. And so that's kind of what was going on in Roman culture. These women who were you know, using gold and pearls in their hair. They would weave gold, you know, pieces or gold strands into their hair, and they'd weave pearls into their hair and into their braids and whatnot. And they'd braid it, and they'd have intricate braids and all this costly stuff too that they put in their hair, the wings and all this kind of stuff. It was just all to show off how wealthy they were and whether, and, you know, that they're a woman of status. And it's kind of, you know, I guess, I don't even know.
Well, it's interesting. It's almost like a tieback to, we've already discussed a few times the last discussion that we had almost a year ago in this renewal movement. Yeah. I mean, it really seems to tie into that culture pretty well. And that, because that's kind of something they're known for, is the women of that, of Pentecostalism and, you know, Word of Faith tend to be very much, you know, with jewelry and expensive clothes and, you know, showing off their money and showing off, you know, how God has financially blessed them, if, you know, as they would say.
Every faith healer has a wife who's got a trophy wife who's got a lot of gold and bling and drives a nice car and blah, blah, blah. And that's exactly it. Mm-hmm. And so Paul is saying in 1 Timothy 2, women, don't do that. Don't act like that. That's not what makes you spiritual. That's not what God considers worthwhile and valuable. And so that's why he contrasts that with self-control. And he talks about modesty, which is, you know, is basically making yourself low, averting your eyes, being humble. That's what God wants, as opposed to, you know, having a $25,000 watch that you wear with an evening gown. And people are like, why the heck is she wearing a big gaudy watch with an evening gown? Well, it's because she wants people to see it's a $25,000 watch.
Yeah.
Right. And it looks dumb, and you're like, you don't normally wear a watch of an evening gown, but she does because she wants people to see that watch, because that watch says, I've got cash. I've got so much cash that I can just spend it on, you know, little baubles like this watch. Oh, $25,000. Oh, I just got what was on top of the dresser and got myself a timepiece.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, Christian women should not be like that. And then the implications there, of course, right away go towards something that I've encountered in church a lot. And my wife, as we were talking through this, and even as she was reading it, she's realizing that we dealt with the other modesty text of 1 Peter 3. And I kind of hammered that, but the ideas are the same, and the underlying ideas are the same. Like, so that Peter says, well, likewise, wives, be subject to your own husbands. If some don't obey the word, they may be warned without a word by the conduct of their wives when they see a respectful and pure conduct. Mm-hmm. You know, do not let your adorning be external, the braiding of hair, putting on gold jewelry and clothing you wear, but let your adorning be the hidden person of the heart, the imperishable beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which God said is very precious. And so I spent kind of two posts more or less saying that, you know, women who are, you know, in a situation that's difficult, they have to subject themselves to their husbands. You know, you have to basically take God's appointed role for you and do what God asks you to do. So it's not being a doorman. It's not he makes all the decisions, or he's the only one who's allowed to use a map when you're in the car or whatever. I've heard so many bizarre examples of what, you know, this means. Well, no, it's that you want to, you want your husband, you want to earn his affection, or not earn his affection, but you want to attract him with your conduct, with how you carry yourselves, and not be a trophy wife who just kind of looks good and wears expensive stuff and shows that off. And I kind of got through this. I kind of realized, wow, that's something that I know a lot of women who fall into that trap. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of older women who, by the standards of Scripture, are not modest at all, and they're the ones who are condemning the younger ones for being immodest.
Yeah, because they're getting the context wrong, and that's the whole point of the discussion: is what is Paul speaking about when he says to be modest? Is, you know, we just assume that he's talking about you know, like communicating promiscuity. When, as you just described, that's not it at all.
Right. And so it's, Paul's not he's not talking, you know, the problem in the church in Ephesus wasn't that all the women dressed like they were prostitutes. And, you know, and I see that in church where the older women who sometimes, I mean, yeah, I don't know if I want to say too much because, of course, I've gone to church with women and if they listen to the podcast, I don't know that I'm talking about them.
Yeah.
But I mean, I have seen older women in churches who often will do things like wear very expensive stuff or have handbags. And my wife will notice it and be like, wow, that's a, you know, and says the brand of that's a, whatever, a Fendi handbag or something like that, where it's a, you know, a $3,000 handbag, and they wear it and they take it to church. And other women, younger women who see that, and they're, you fall into that trap of thinking, wow, she's better than me. God's blessed her. She's really got it together. That's yeah. amazing. And you end up coveting and envying, and it becomes a distraction. And then you tend to see those women as more spiritual.
Yeah.
And what Paul's saying is, no, those are the women who are less spiritual. They're the women you don't want to copy. They're the women who don't get it. You don't understand what godly character is, because godly character doesn't flaunt that and shove that in people's faces in the form of gold in your hair and braids and showing off. I mean, the idea of gold and braids basically says that I have slaves who are dedicated to the sole purpose of doing my hair. I'm loaded. And because of that, of course, that's a natural reaction that we always think of, is that, you know, people who have money, whose lives are together, they have that. And our natural reaction is to think these people are more spiritual than we are, that God's favoring them more. As much as we profess to not believe the prosperity gospel, it is an easy temptation to fall into for the best of us.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, when you see a guy, I mean, it's a guy, you see someone who's in your church. He's got an older guy. He's got it together. He's, you know, always cordial and nice. He dresses, you know, he drives a BMW. He's got nice clothes. His kids seem to be happy. And then I've had time and again where that guy has all of a sudden turned out. There's a massive moral failure under the surface. And yeah. It came out, and the guy was shamed and left the church. And you can't. People were surprised. You think, well, why are they surprised? Why is he the one that everyone's shocked at? Because everyone thought he was more spiritual than the rest of them. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I remember hearing R.C. Sproul once a long time ago saying that, you know, there's a problem in our church in that 90% of the elders board just happen to be the only guy, you know, the guys in church who are rich. And we just, for some reason, tend to put them in power because they're wealthy and have a job that's a prestigious job. And we think they're spiritual, and they're not. They're not the ones who necessarily understand the scriptures, and they're not the ones who are wise and have, you know, godly character. And sometimes in a church, you know, the women who are godly are the ones who aren't flaunting it, and the ones who, you know, the ones who stay after and help clean up when everybody takes off, and the ones who you don't know if they're the ones who show up when, you know, there's that. I mean, I'm thinking of my church right now. There's, you know, a family who has a baby, and the mom is their first baby, and the mom is just facing the nuclear bomb that's kind of gone off in her house and realizing, I haven't slept in weeks and I'm tired and I'm just feeling horrible. I can't bring myself to get food together, and I'm just, because I'm feeding this child every 3 hours or whatever it is, and this baby just never lets up, and I'm, after, you know, several weeks of this, I'm just a zombie.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's certain people in a church, you know, in churches, certain people that kind of help for a little while. They're like, oh, I've done my week. And then there's always a few other women who are still there 2 or 3 months later, and they're giving of themselves. They're like, I'm here. Let me, you know, what can I do to help you? Do you need food? Do you want me to come help you, you know, clean your house? I can just, you know, you want me to just come and take the baby and take it for a few hours and you can sleep, and I'll just take care of her, and I'll put her on, I give her a bottle once. And then the young mom says, oh no, my baby's on a bottle once. She'll all of a sudden never go back. And then the old lady says, no, I had 6 kids. They all went from me to a bottle and back again, no problem. They're not that petty, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, we'll give you 6 hours to sleep, and they kind of help her. And, you know, and I see that too. And it's sad when the ones who kind of are seen as spiritual are the ones that have money, and that's a trap we fall into, and we don't necessarily notice the ones who are committed servants, who have self control, who are the ones who are quieter. And
well,
my goodness, when I was young,
I would like to just point out that Paul's not saying, he's not saying don't have means, don't have money. He's just saying don't make a show out of it.
Right.
Right. So it's a very important distinction. I mean, God does bless people in different ways, and some people he blesses financially, but those who are mature about it know how to take that blessing and not make a big show about it, and can treat others with respect and humility, who might not have those same blessings.
Right. And the other thing too is that, I mean, having money is not wrong, right? I mean, the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. Yeah. People get that verse wrong so much.
Yeah.
You know, the love of money is the root of all evil. No, it's not. It's all kinds of evil, and it's the love of money, not having money. And I know some people who are great and godly people who make more money in a day than I can even imagine. I've had the weird opportunity to meet a few people who are worth like hundreds of millions of dollars. And I also know people who make just a little bit more than I do, and they are in debt up the wazoo because they are just stretched on their credit to the nines because they try and live like they are. You know, the guys who make $100,000 a year try to live like they're millionaires.
Mm-hmm.
They try to show off to the world they're living, and you find out that these guys are, you know, making $100,000 a year. They're $2 million in debt.
Yeah.
And you're like, wait a minute, what are you doing? And why do you have all this stuff? And why do you just kind of play with credit and become good at kind of making credit work and living way beyond your means? And you dress and you have all these toys, and your wife has all these clothes, all these shoes and handbags, and they buy stuff to be seen. And that is something that the Bible really takes a bit of an issue with.
Yeah.
And Christians should not be that and should not act like that. That's not modest. And the thing is, guys can be immodest equally.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I hate to almost cut you off here. I'm kind of coming up against a couple of time crunches here. First of all, we're talking over my cell phone. Patched into the soundboard, and I got a big red light on here. Despite being plugged into power, it seems to be draining power faster than it's charging. So I don't know how much time I got left. And then I earlier, about the time we took our break, I was getting texts from my wife about kids that were not behaving themselves well. So I should probably get up to do my dad duties too. But I don't want to cut you too harshly here. You did get a little bit in. You kind of finished off with, you know, not totally leaving people hanging. You know, you started off kind of hinting that, you know, we're going to talk about modesty, and people assumed what modesty meant. And you kind of finished off the series kind of getting back to what people thought you were going to talk about and covering it a little bit. And I don't know how much you might want to get into that tonight, but I would recommend people go through the series, and you know, we talked about it a lot, but it's a good finish. And I think you had good points to make on the, you know, the closing statements as well too.
Well, thank you. In the first six posts, first seven posts, it's modesty is not about clothes. Modesty is not about covering up. Modesty is about basically showing off your money and making people think you're more spiritual than you are by how you dress and how you attire. And trying to give yourself, you know, show that you're somebody who is a person of means, and insinuating that, you know, God has blessed you and whatnot, and that you're spiritual on the basis of how you look. Mm-hmm. But the end of it, kind of dealing with all the questions about clothes, skirt lengths, you know, bathing suits.
And people still want to know.
Yeah, people still right away are like, wait a minute, what's that? Well, in Paul's day, that would be essentially dressing like a prostitute.
Yeah,
and not even a shameful one, like a very brazen one. Mm-hmm. And so what I talked about then is, well, when people talk about kind of what you can cover, what you can uncover, it's that question isn't, you know, what can I wear and whatnot, but what does the Bible say about nakedness?
Yeah,
and that's when we went over. And I did a quick study of that, and the Bible is really outspoken about nakedness and covering yourself up, and that you want to be very careful to not expose your nakedness, which means basically keeping your body covered. And then it's, and the Bible doesn't lay out a list of rules about what nakedness means per se. There's a couple of passages that talk about that. There's some rules in Exodus and Leviticus and stuff that give you hints. And it's something that's left up to your conscience, but people who display their nakedness and just, you know, they reveal their bodies, act shamefully. And you, women who do that should be ashamed of themselves.
Yeah.
They should be, they should realize that God speaks out against that very bad. And then I kind of went to Ezekiel 16 and insinuated to it in Ezekiel 23 that there's some incredibly graphic metaphors there of Israel and how they acted like a prostitute, just a brazen prostitute.
Yeah.
And so if that's kind of what the Bible holds up as about nakedness and kind of uncovering your body, then why would you do that? You shouldn't. You don't want to go there. You don't want to be a beeline to go there. So just kind of trying to stay away from that. And I didn't give any rules, but I just gave some general principles of just try how to avoid that and things to think about when you're avoiding that. And then the general question that comes up always about, well, what about Christian guys? I don't want to cause them to stumble and talk about that issue. And it's actually the stumbling thing is really between women. It has nothing to do with men. young girls cannot mind read young boys and what will make them stumble. Because really, if you're worried about if they're going to make someone stumble, it'll make someone stumble. You don't know how many, but you know, someone will write it down. Don't worry about that. Cover your body. Don't be naked. Cover. Stay as far away from nakedness as you can. Now, as
within
much as
reason.
Your conscience.
Oh, yeah, within,
yeah
reason.
Within reason.
I like how you said, as long, you know, within reason. And if it involves welding, it's not within reason.
Yeah, don't do anything absurd that could somehow weld up, you know, something or whatever. You know, I'm trying to be silly there, but I don't want to. Yeah. I wanted to stay really far from kind of giving any sort of rule. And don't judge other women for how they dress as well, but go and cover yourself up. So if there's any questions, if your conscience bothers you, cover it up. Put more on.
Mm-hmm.
And if your conscience doesn't bother you, well, then make sure you're, you know, educating your conscience from the scriptures. And make sure you kind of read the passages and read what God says about people who are naked and you're not ashamed. They bring on themselves. They act shamefully. And, you know, and if you can do it with a sound conscience before God, then, well, that's between you and God. And if other women see what you're doing and say, well, hang on a second, you need to realize, then, you know, take that seriously and listen to some of the godly women who are around you. And you're constantly going to be growing towards being more covered up, and you should. And there's no, you know, you want to be a woman who doesn't have to be ashamed. You don't want to look back at yourself and say 10 years ago and realize how you're dressed and just be ashamed of yourself. So don't do it and flee from that. And so that kind of covers basically all the various incarnations of the questions that come with what's assumed to be modest, you know, well, you know, causing a brother to stumble. What can I wear? What can't I wear? Whatever. But don't be naked and don't worry about what the guys think. Just cover yourself up.
Very well said. Lyndon, thanks so much, not only for coming on, but I really, like I said, I appreciate the study. I always really do appreciate when people kind of challenge the common thinking on things and kind of disregard it and go in and just dig in and see what does history say? What is the cultural context? What is the grammatical context? You know, what's behind this?
Yeah.
Is it as simple as we all think? And, you know, I thank you for putting in the effort to dig in there and investigate that for us.
Thanks so much for having me on the program, Andy.
Yeah. So, again, before my battery dies, I probably should close, but I greatly appreciate your time and thanks for both starting and ending the eighth year of Echo Zoe Radio with me.
I'm glad to be the bookends of Echo Zoe.
Of year eight, yeah.
Echo Zoe Radio is an outreach of Echo Zoe Ministries. If you are blessed by the show, please consider offering your support. There are many things you can do to help, including prayer, sharing the show with others, and your financial support. Echo Zoe Ministries is a registered nonprofit organization with 501c3 tax-exempt status, and your donations are tax-deductible. For more information about how you can support Echo Zoe Ministries, please visit echozoe.com/support.
Well, that wraps up episode 96. Thanks for listening to Echo Zoe Radio. For show notes, visit echozoe.com/96. Also at the website are links to connect to Echo Zoe on social media. We're on Twitter, Facebook, and Google+, and love to connect with you. So follow, like, or circle Echo Zoe Ministries. As this episode closes the 8th year of Echo Zoe Radio, I'd like to express gratitude to the guests that have come on over the last year. Fred Butler, Steve Cooley, Gabe Hughes, Alan Kirshner, Kofi Adu-Bowen, Ryan Habana, Frank Turk, Dr. R. Scott Clark, Nate Pickowitz, Jason York, and the guy who both started and ended year 8 with us, Lyndon Unger. In addition to those 11 men, I'm greatly thankful for those of you who deliberately make the effort to download the podcast each month and listen, and those of you who engage with me in one way or another over the year via social media, email, or otherwise. I thank my wife and family for the time and energy they give that allows me to do this show every month, and I thank the Lord for his rich blessings that allow me to be in his service through Echo Zoe Ministries. Lord willing, I'll be back next month to begin the 9th year of the podcast with the May 2016 episode of Echo Zoe Radio.